after I'd been after I'd blown the whistle and been sacked, and of course there were other parts of that. They didn't just sack me. They started this tabloid newspaper campaign about my love life and all kinds of, and made accusations that I was an alcoholic, that I was issuing visas in exchange for sex. There was an allegation that I'd driven a Land Rover down a flight of stairs, which was, I have no idea where we got that from, because I've never driven a car in my entire life. I can't drive. But they leaked all these lurid accusations to the tabloids, which again is something they do with whistleblowers. You know, they just try to destroy your reputation entirely. And the sexual allegations, you know, of visas in exchange for sex. And the interesting thing is they could never, ever, they tried very hard. They tried very, very hard. They couldn't find a single person who would make an accusation. Mm. And they made the accusation, then went looking for people to back it up. And I know they contacted probably hundreds, but certainly scores of women I'd been in contact with one way or another throughout my career, and asked them if they'd make accusations against me. And nobody would, very nice. I think, fortunately, I'd always been an extremely kind boss and given people holidays when they wanted and helped them out and that kind of thing. So they couldn't find anyone who actually had a grudge against me in any way. But they contacted. I'll tell you a risque story. Here's a risque story. I was phoned by a young lady who'd worked for me in Poland while I was in the British. I was first secretary at the British Embassy then. She'd been employed by me. And she said, "Craig, what the hell is happening?" She said, "I just had a phone call from the Foreign Office. And they said, when I was working for you, did you ever make a pass at me?" She said. And I said, "What?" And she said, "Yeah, no, they phoned me and asked that." And she said, "And I said to them, no, you hadn't, but I wish you had." And that was lovely. I think she was joking. But they did. They just tried to contact so many people and get somebody to make an allegation against me. They couldn't get anyone to make any allegation against me. But that use of sexual slur is, of course, resonates with Julian's case, and also with my friend Alex Salmond, for example. And it's very, very common against dissidents. Now you try and turn their natural support is on the left, so you try to, you know, use sexual allegations to turn the left against them. And that is absolutely from the security service playbook. So it was a difficult time. But one thing, there's then a huge amount of publicity, which by and large turned favourable towards me. I mean, by and large, the newspapers were very supportive of me, which was a good thing. And then a friend, of course, I'd been in the Foreign Office for over 20 years, and I still had many good friends in the office. And nobody I thought was a friend deserted me. In fact, very few people, it's one of the interesting things, very few people in the Foreign Office ever deserted me or cut me socially because of my whistleblowing. And even sort of more famous Foreign Office people like Christopher Meyer, the ambassador in Washington, Jeremy Greenstock, the ambassador to the United Nations, and others, were still perfectly nice to me socially and openly friendly and supportive in a social sense, if you see what I mean. But one friend of mine who was still in the office was invited to a seminar in the office on lessons of the Craig Murray incident. What do we do? Because there's been this big, huge national front page story about all the things that involving me, several national front page stories. And he went along and he thought, you know, this was going to say things like, what do we do about this? Maybe we should stop torturing people. They might be looking at that kind of lesson. But in fact, the entire seminar and sort of it was a sort of thinking meeting, you know, where people got a round table conversation about how do we stop this kind of problem arise again. And the entire thing focused on how do we make sure we never recruit another Craig Murray. Mm. That was the actual, you know, they spent a day discussing how to make sure nobody like Craig Murray ever gets recruited again, which is right. I mean, and now it is, I think, included in the... We had... I was interviewed by psychiatrists before I joined. It was part of the recruitment process already, certainly for the fast stream, but that you had psychiatric interviews. But they didn't... They weren't designed to weed out honourable people. But I think the redesign of that was part of the lessons of you know, how do you never recruit another Craig Murray?
Well, of course, if you weed out the people with a high degree of integrity and conscience, you end up with a workforce that is less quality, right?
You do. But I'm one of the unknowns here. I was very unusual in being at my level in those days. I say it may have changed a little now, in not having come from a private education or whatever, which makes you wonder whether the problem hadn't really arisen before because people from a private education don't tend to have a social conscience or as much of a social conscience or as much personal integrity. Or you know, is there something about that class background? And the fact, do I have more notion of solidarity with my fellow men because I actually come from a poor family? You know, that's an interesting question to which I don't know the answer, and I'm sure you can find plenty of psychopaths who came from poor families. Yeah. But I'm not claiming there's a 100% correlation, but I do think that my immunity from groupthink, from the fact I didn't have the same social background as the other people who were my peers, I think that must be a factor. It's hard to think it isn't a factor.
What do people not understand about the way diplomacy works? Or
I think the most important thing about diplomacy, and probably the least understood thing, is that it's about personal relationships more than anything. You know, but 99% of effective diplomacy is forging an effective personal relationship with the person you are dealing with. Funnily enough, of all the things I'm proudest of, the thing I'm probably proudest of is having established the compromise that enabled the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea to come into force. The UN Convention on the Law of the Sea had been around for something like 25 years when I became the head of the Foreign Office's Maritime Section and head of the delegation, the UK delegation, the preparatory commission of the United Nations on the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. And it was a conundrum, it was a Gordian knot. Nobody could get the Law of the Sea Convention to actually come into force, which is a very, very important convention containing a lot of extremely important stuff on rights of passage through straits, on fishing rights, on who owns a continental shelf. It's an extremely important part of international law. And the whole convention had become stuck over the issue of mining on the deep seabed, basically extracting minerals from a seabed where nobody owns it, where it's the high seas. And it contained provisions which essentially socialized the areas of the sea which are not owned by any country, out with the 200 miles or continental shelf limit, and set up an international tribunal and an international body where if you wanted to mine minerals from a deep seabed, you have to get a license from this international body. You can do it for profit, but then the revenue is essentially taxed and shared with developing nations. It was a kind of... but of course, this had led the United States and the United Kingdom to refuse to sign the entire convention on the grounds of this terrible socialist provision. And finding, and the for developing nations, this became an entire symbol of what is the international system for. Now, is it just something that developed states use to pursue their interests? Or can there be at least one area where developing nations actually get for nothing something out of the system? And I should say, in those days, people believed that the mining, particularly of manganese from a deep seabed, was going to be massively profitable one day. Maybe it will be, I don't know, it's not my expertise. But there was just this complete impasse. You know, the delegates just could not agree, and the UK and the US were hardly talking to the developed nations, whatever. And when I took over the maritime section, I went to five different sessions of the UN Preparatory Commission. I'm quite certain that what enabled that convention to come into force was my forging personal relationships with the developing state representatives. Mm. Because most diplomats are terrible at this. I mean, most Western diplomats don't socialise with the African diplomats. You know, they socialise with each other. They don't go out drinking or eating with the African and South Asian delegates. It's like different camps. And I absolutely went out of my way to spend all my time with the other side, if you see what I mean. And establish with them over the course of a couple of years that I was a genuine person, not to discuss the Convention on the Law of the Sea with them. We went to cricket matches together in Jamaica and we did all kinds of stuff. Just to get to know them on a personal basis and win their trust and get over to them that, look, I'm a genuine person. I actually believe in this. We've got to make some tweaks to get the United States on board, but we will get the system in some form into place. It won't be quite as good, but we want to do this because we believe in it. And we succeeded. And there was a protocol drafted with some minor amendments, which was then signed by the whole world. And the convention is now in force. And most of the drafting in that protocol is by me. It's my writing. And it's interesting. Well, other than people who watch this, because it's something nobody will ever know, if you see what I mean. It doesn't say Craig Murray anywhere on the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. But that was done by, and the key drafting points were literally, they were cleared by me and the guy who was the chairman of the Developing Nations Group in the United Nations for this subject, a guy called Dolivan Nelson, lovely guy from Trinidad, I think, and the Undersecretary General of the UN for Law of the Sea, who was a guy called Satya Nandan. And the three of us finalised the wording, drinking rum punch, standing in the shallow end of the swimming pool at the Pegasus Hotel in Kingston, Jamaica. That's how diplomacy should be done. You know, that is the secret of diplomacy, to actually make genuine friends on the other side. You can't do it through simple negotiation like lawyers talking across each other. There has to be more to it. It has to have an artistic element, not a purely logical element. And I don't claim to be unique. I'm telling my achievement, but all the best diplomats, all the really good diplomats can do that. You know, they have the ability to reach out and form a cultural understanding and grounds of personal friendship with the other side. And you have to be able to form personal friendship even with people with whom you have quite big differences. And there has to be a genuine element to that personal friendship, even though it doesn't mean to say you agree on everything at all. Sure. You have to find a way of bonding. It's quite a... Diplomacy really is an art, it done properly. I fear it's a dying art. I think there's very little of that nowadays. Certainly the British Foreign Office does much less fraternising with the other side, let me put it that way. When I was in the Foreign Office, when I served in Poland, I had to speak Polish. I had to be fluent in Polish. When I was in Russia and in Tashkent, I had to be fluent in Russian. You know, and the office was prepared to put aside a year and a half of my life to do nothing but intensive language study and to pay me during that period. Wow. Those kind of skills are disappearing. They're fewer and fewer people now have them in the office because they're not prepared to put in the investment. And it's all viewed as much more transactional. you know, all the time spent in cultivating friendships and things. And of course, the taxpayer being prepared to pick up your tab for being in the Pegasus Hotel shallow pool in Jamaica, or being at the cricket match for, you know, with a key delegate thing. That's all disappearing. Mm. So I fear diplomacy is not as useful as it was. But it was something I really loved. You can probably tell I loved it.
Yes.
I mean, that's one of the horrible things. I actually was giving up something I really loved, you know, when I gave up being a diplomat.
What was Margaret Thatcher like?
She was very nice to me. She was very friendly. She was terrifying. When I was seeing her, I had to present her a report on basically everything that happened overnight. I was awake all night, seeing all the intelligence, anything to do with the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, which had happened, and the forthcoming invasion of Iraq, first invasion of Iraq, which hadn't yet happened. But all the preparations, everything.
This is 1990.
This would be 91, 92, one. Back then. Okay. I was up all night reading everything, synthesizing everything, writing a report, clearing it with the other people I was with, who were Defense Intelligence Service and the Navy and various other people, then taking it to her and explaining it. Now, there would always be something you weren't sure of. You know, you'd got this bit of information and this bit of information, but you lacked that bit. And there would always be these little lacunae in your knowledge. And she just had this uncanny ability to realize what it was you don't know and ask you that. And it really was almost psychic the way she could do it. You know, she would, and she did seem to take pleasure in belittling people to some extent, intellectually, to some extent. I'm happy to say I didn't much suffer from it. She seemed to actually quite like me and seemed to appreciate my no-nonsense-ness, if you like, my plain speaking. She always thought my name was Peter. No matter how many times I contradicted her, she always called her Peter, which actually came in very useful because I was ambassador in Poland. I was first secretary at the embassy in Poland shortly after, and a couple of years after she'd finished being prime minister. And she came out to Poland, and the ambassador was really hacked off that he didn't know her personally, and I did, because this was a status thing, if you see what I mean. He was really annoyed, and I was really worried that she was going to be very friendly to me, and he was going to get very angry with me. And when she saw me in the embassy, she came up to me, and she didn't have to give me a hug, but she shook my hand, and she said, "Peter, how are you?" Which was perfect, because he then could take a piss out of me for weeks because she thought my name was Peter. "I thought you knew her. She didn't know who you are. She thought you were Peter." You know, he very much enjoyed that sort of power trip, but it saved him actually being angry with me, which was quite nice.
She was from a similar social background.
She was from a similar social background, which I think helped. Mm. At an earlier stage in my career, which had been very shortly after she became Prime Minister, when I was second secretary of the British High Commission in Lagos, she came on a state visit, and I was given the task of looking after Dennis for the day.
This is Thatcher's husband.
Thatcher's husband. And I took Dennis off, and he'd asked to go see British businesses in Nigeria. So I took him, first of all, I took him to the Guinness factory, because Guinness's biggest factory, their biggest brewery, is in Nigeria.
Wow.
That's bigger than the one in Dublin. Which anyway, I took him to a Guinness brewery, and then I took him to the Johnny Walker bottling pub, and I took him to the golf club for lunch. And then we went, I can't remember where else we went, because by that time we were both totally pissed, because he drinks like fish, and we were both absolutely smashed out of our brains. And then I had to get him back to State House for a state banquet at 6 o'clock. And we turned up half an hour late and absolutely smashed. And she was standing on the state banquet was ready to start. She had left the state banquet and was standing on her own on the steps of State House waiting for him. And this is before the Gulf War thing, before I knew her from then. And he said, "Oh, Christ, she's here. She says she'll be furious. She'll be furious." He said, "Quick, get down so she can't see you." And so I lay on the floor of the Land Rover by her back seat so she couldn't see I was there. And he staggered out the car and got yelled at by his wife, which was quite funny. And the driver, lovely Nigerian driver, no idea what was happening. And Dennis sort of shut the door and went off, and the driver sort of looked round at me. I said, don't look. He said, "Are you going in?" I said, no, I'm not going to State Bank. Just drive. I was yelling, you know, from this recumbent position on the floor. So that was quite but it's interesting because, of course, I detested her policies in terms of what she did to, you know, the economy of the north of the UK in particular, well, you know, the amount of unnecessary industrial destruction and the havoc, the social havoc that wreaked. I was utterly opposed to her policy on South Africa because she supported apartheid. There's no doubt of it. You know, people try to smooth over that. But she was an out-and-out supporter of apartheid. Obviously, I detested that. But actually, on a personal level, I found her perfectly nice, which is peculiar and not something to say in company, because people get very angry when you say you found Margaret Thatcher nice.
What is the relationship between the FCO and the security services? Like, when you're out in serving in the mission in wherever it is, how is that dynamic? And
well, MI6 operate under diplomatic cover. They pretend to be members of the FCO, if you like. And they do that both at home and abroad. So people who work in MI6 don't say socially, "I work for MI6. They say, "I work in the Foreign Office."
But who knows they're MI6?
In such and such department. Their partner probably knows.
I mean, within the...
Well, they don't actually work in the Foreign Office. They work in... I'm talking the UK. So, you know, they'll work in Vauxhall Cross.
Right.
They will pretend that they work in whichever department of the Foreign Office. And they will come... You're there working in that department of the Foreign Office. You'll be introduced to them. They will come to see you. So they'll be able to look and sit, and they'll look around so they can talk about the surroundings of things as though they worked there. You'll meet them to remind you that if anyone phones up and asks for them, you say, "No, he's just popped out." You don't say, "No, he doesn't work here."
Right.
So that's their cover in the UK. When you're overseas, they pretend to be ordinary diplomats in the mission, though they work in a different secure area of the mission. All of the diplomatic staff will know that they're MI6. I think all of the UK-based staff, because I don't think anyone can work overseas in the Foreign Office at a diplomatic level without having top secret clearance anyway. So
except for the secretaries and so on?
No, most of the secretaries and people would have top secret clearances as well, because they'll be moving around and top secret material and stuff. So. Yeah, so basically, people know who the spies are.
And what's the profile of people in MI6, as opposed to the Foreign Office, for example?
MI6 is very, very similar to the Foreign Office. Very Oxbridge, very aristocratic. Of course, it's not done by competitive examination, so
they're recruited. They're just headhunted.
Yeah, so they. They tend to be people of, you know, right-wing political views. Probably no left-wingers in MI6, I would guess.
So are they recruited from the Foreign Office?
No. Although you can be. I mean, I was asked to join MI6 after I'd been in the Foreign Office a couple of years, but MI6 asked me if I'd be interested to transfer. But mostly they're not. Mostly they're recruited straight from university.
One a journalist I spoke to was working in one of the major papers, and he said that his superior at the paper tried to recruit him for MI6.
Yeah, it's perfectly, and they have recruiters in different places that they trust to try and put people in. People get confused between officers and agents. And here James Bond is much to blame, because James Bond is not an agent. James Bond is an officer. Officers recruit agents. Agents are informants. Agent just means informant, basically. Mm. No one in the MI6 who works there is an agent. So within the service, within the Foreign Office, you know, you have MI6 officers. They then will go out and recruit agents to give them information.
And how many agents know that they're agents? This is always, because I think like the officer is probably good at manipulating people.
Yeah.
And
I think almost always they do. I think officers cultivate people to find out if they're in a position to give them information. Mm-hmm. They don't just go chat up people and get information, because that's what diplomats do. If you like, that was
right.
My job.
Okay.
Different people have different motivations in becoming agents. In a few cases, it's ideological. Yeah. And that only really works where you're in a country that has a different ideology to your own. But you may have had, you know, people in Soviet times in Russia who became British agents because they believed in the Western ideals of whatever. They're a tiny minority of people, and by and large they're not much looked for because they tend to be nutters. You know, people motivated by ideology tend not to be terribly reliable in many ways. The much more normal, 90% of MI6's agents are motivated by cash. They're just paid.
Wow.
And paid huge sums of money. Mm. When I was in Poland, at times when the deputy head of mission was on leave and I was acting deputy head of mission, I had to at times sign out money to give the MI6 people. And I'd have to sign out $500,000 at a time in cash and hand over to them. And one of the fascinating things about this is it's totally unreceipted, you know, because they can't, you know, if you're giving $100,000 to an agent, an informant, in return for some information, you can't ask him for a receipt. So MI6 officers handle vast amounts of bribery cash, taxpayers' money, for which there's no receipting whatsoever, which is why nearly all MI6 agents have huge houses by the River Thames.
Right.
I was often very suspicious about where a lot of this money was coming, but I'm going, absolutely nothing I can do about it. The difficulty of the system is, of course, when it came to the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, MI6 did have intelligence. They didn't invent the intelligence. They had intelligence on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, given to them by a succession of Iraqi colonels who they met in, you know, hotel rooms in Egypt and said, if I give you $5 million in cash, will you give me intelligence on Iraqi weapons of mass destruction? And of course, he goes, yes, of course.
You're not going to say no to that.
Yeah, what do you need to know? Yes, we've got loads. We've got loads and loads and loads. Here you are. In fact, next week I'll tell you about some more for another $5 million. And so this intelligence existed. They didn't invent it, but it was just bollocks because, you know, you don't get reliable intelligence by paying people for it. And there's a wonderful novel which is absolutely right. It's absolutely spot on, true to the real world, called Our Man in Havana by Graham Greene. Mm. And Graham Greene, of course, was an MI6 officer. And it tells the story of a vacuum cleaner salesman who gets in a position to be paid by the security services for information on a secret rocket project. And he keeps handing them designs of the internal workings of vacuum cleaners and getting paid all this money for it. And then, of course, he gets into a terrific muddle and he's going to get found out and it all goes terribly wrong in a Graham Greene way. But But Graham Greene, and Graham Greene knew, he was an MI6 officer himself, you know, knew exactly how this nonsense works. It's quite quite interesting. But the other method, of course, you've got ideology, you've got paying people for it, and the other method's blackmail, which is not a normal method of operation, only be used against specially targeted individuals where you're desperate to get information, but you know you only get it from that person. How the hell do you get him? And if you can't, if the other things don't work, then they might try blackmail. But they don't do it much at all. It used to be common. It's very unusual nowadays.
This is, I think, what Snowden says irked him about when he was working, I think, for the CIA in Geneva, and he started getting involved in some blackmail-style operations, and he started turning him his conscience against what he was doing. Well, that's very interesting. Maybe we're going to have to do another conversation at another time, because we could. There are so many things I'd like to talk to you about.
Yeah, we'll have to. We'll do a part two coming next year.